Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes. My name is Carl Shinneman. I'm Director of Legal Analytics and Review with Juranov. Here at ESI Bytes, of course, we attempt to offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free and available when they're interested in listening to it. Today we have two of my friends on the show, and it's an interesting topic, and I'm really looking forward to this. So we're going to talk about e-discovery issues in Web 2.0, 3.0 world, and social media. The panel today, our first, Ron Hedges, who's had extensive experience in e-discovery and management of complex civil litigation matters. He was appointed in 1986 and served until 2007 as a United States Magistrate Judge in the United States District Court for the District of New Jersey, serving as a compliance judge for the Court Mediation Program, a member of the Lawyers Advisory Committee, and both a member and reporter for the Civil Justice Reform Act Advisory Committee. He has also been the chair of the BNA Advisory Board for Digital Discovery and E-Evidence. That's a publication I think very highly of, written for, and done podcasts for, and Jim Shook has as well. He's a member of the Sedona Conference Advisory Board, the Sedona Conference Working Group on Protective Orders, Confidentiality, and Public Access, and the Sedona Conference Working Group on Best Practices for Electronic Document Retention and Production, as well as a member of Sedona Canada. He's also a member of the National Law Alumni Board and the advisory boards of the Corporate Counsel and eDiscovery Institutes of Georgetown University Law Center, and also co-chair on the Planning Committee of the Georgetown University Law Center's Advanced eDiscovery Institute in November 2007. Also a member of ARMA and has been author of numerous publications on eDiscovery, including Discovery of Electronic Information, Surveying the Legal Landscape by BNA in 2007. Ron, thanks for joining us on the show.
You're welcome. Good morning.
Okay, and the second panelist is a good friend of mine, James D. Shook. Jim is what I call him. He's a senior legal consultant, e-discovery and compliance at EMC Corporation. He's recognized authority on legal discovery and compliance issues related to electronic information. On a regular basis, he discusses e-discovery, compliance, and privacy issues with companies throughout the world, sharing best practices and discussing challenges, working to develop and deploy real-world solutions to these problems. Jim is also a longtime member of the Sedona Conference, like Ron. He's a well-known legal think tank. He's active on several committees. He's an editor on the Electronic Discovery Reference Model, EDRM. He also publishes and speaks regularly at conferences on technology's impact on legal issues, including the national publication of Avoiding FAA Discovery, written with Andrew Cohen in 2008. Recently, and sort of the basis of the show, Jim's focus on some of the emerging issues in this field. He published an article on the legal impact of collaboration technologies, A Tangled eDiscovery Web 2.0, in December of 2008, in BNA's Digital Discovery and E-Evidence. He's been a practicing attorney at a large Phoenix law firm for 10 years before that. I also worked closely with Jim at Special Counsel as part of their National E-Discovery Initiative for a couple of years, so that's how I know Jim. So anyway, we have a technologist in Jim, and we've got a former judge and e-discovery consultant in Ron. So I think we're set to tackle emerging technologies. So let's get started here. First of all, Jim, why don't you tell me how you got interested in electronic discovery, and then I'll ask Ron the same question.
Thanks, Carl. Great to be here, and appreciate being invited on the show. I have a background in computer science, but my start was I was general counsel to a small public company in 2000, and we were sued by a much larger company, which hit us with the give us everything, including all of the electronic data. And even though I had a good background in IT, it was kind of eye-opening to see how many data sources we had, how many backups and things like that. And my interest just grew from that case as we moved forward, both in-house and then moving into different roles after that time.
Okay, and Ron, yourself?
I had, as you said, been on a bench for a number of years, and several years ago, I wound up being involved and deciding a discovery dispute between parties in a patent infringement action where preservation of emails was an issue. And I wrote several opinions on it, and that's how I got involved in discovery of electronically stored information.
Okay. Well, Jim, let's start by defining some of these non-traditional technologies that have made their way into the workspace. What are you talking about in that area?
Well, and it's funny because as I was thinking about this, everything is a non-traditional technology until it becomes mainstream, right? So I know when I started practicing law at a firm, attorneys didn't use computers. It was frowned upon. There really was no email. And then you look 5 years, 10 years down the line, and all that stuff is mainstream. You know, over the last 5, 6, 7 years, we've had a lot of technology do the same thing that now is mainstream. Voicemail, getting voicemail recordings by email. You know, we're starting to see more podcasts, texts, and of course, wikis and blogs. And I think now those are much more mainstream in terms of a lot of companies using them. And where we're looking at more cutting-edge things, I think, are right now social sites like Twitter and Facebook are starting to kind of find their way into businesses, whether intentionally or unintentionally. So they create a lot of issues, and I will talk more about them, because who's managing the data, how instantaneous they are, is there really thought behind them? But there's just, I would say those are the main ones that we're seeing right now.
Ron, what are some of the concerns from a legal perspective that you have about these types of innovative technologies when records management and electronic discovery is considered?
Well, as an initial matter, whenever an organization is, if you will, shipping its data outside to the cloud or sharing its data on an interactive site, there are a number of problems. There's a preservation issue about whether or not the data really is yours, and do you have an obligation to impose a litigation hold over it? How would you do it? There are control issues, because once a party is in discovery under Rule 34, there's an obligation to produce information. Basically, that's within a party's possession, custody, or control. So there are serious questions as to who controls data when it's out with someone else. There are privacy issues. Confidentiality issues if an organization allows employees to go out and, say, for example, become involved in an interactive website or a wiki, and some corporate communications or corporate confidences are somehow released. There are also liability issues that an employer may have if an employee goes out and uses one of these technologies and says or does something that could be considered tortious in nature or the like. So I think what you're seeing with these new technologies is there's a need to look at all the traditional issues we've had with e-discovery and ramp them up a little bit, if you want, to deal with third parties or to deal with people who don't even have formal relationships with you.
And this is a little scary since we haven't even completely figured out e-discovery yet. Now we've added another layer of complexity, right?
Absolutely.
Well, let's move back in the caves and start killing saber-toothed tigers, right? Anyway, Jim, from a technical perspective, would you like to add anything about the difficulties created? I know in your article you wrote about blogs and Wikipedia, so why don't we go down some of the specific issues that occur when you're talking about e-discovery with some of these tools?
I think, you know, following up on Ron's point, it's exactly the things that make them difficult for e-discovery and in a legal sense that make them so useful in terms of collaborative technologies within the enterprise. You know, I think what makes them difficult is you can update and publish virtually instantaneously. There's no reflection that needs to be done. There's no review that is necessarily done. They reflect from a authenticity standpoint, they usually reflect the wisdom of a team or a group and not an individual person. And again, that's very useful from a technical standpoint and in terms of publishing that information, say, to an enterprise. Instead of having to call, you know, Carl for an answer, you might be able to go to a wiki that represents a whole team of knowledge that's been collected over time. And they're just, they're difficult to manage and control. You know, these technologies can be deployed by an individual, and they just tend to grow very quickly. And it's all these things from the technical standpoint, you know, the instant updating, the difficulty of tracking, that make them so useful in the enterprise.
Okay. Well, Ron, should we give up on this if we can't control who actually created a document and identify, or manage this outside information? I mean, I know there's some inaccessibility arguments and control arguments you can make under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, which pertain to e-discovery and case law. You know, what do you think?
Well, I don't think there's a way to unring the bell. I'm sure there's some people listening who would be very happy to go back to the days of carbon paper. And
hard no, then they're not listening, Ron.
Well,
we're on the internet.
I know.
Never anyway, go ahead.
But yeah, seriously, there's no way to unring these technologies. Next week or next month, there's going to be another new technology that's going to take the world by storm. And it's really a question of taking our traditional concepts that Jim mentioned before and fitting them into a new technology. And I was just thinking as we were talking that we're probably creating a whole new range of something that we know of as ephemeral information, that there may not be a way to capture it, or there may be a very expensive way to capture it. And the law is going to have to fit that new concept with these technologies into traditional ideas of preservation and control. And how are you going to preserve some of these interactive websites unless you think you're going to somehow be able to take snapshots of them constantly before they change their data? And effectively, you're preserving a picture of something at a certain period of time. And you're not going to be able to preserve all the information that was underlying it under those circumstances, I would assume. So I think it's going to call for a lot more forward-looking thinking by lawyers and by judges as we go ahead.
You know, Ron, I didn't tell you about an article I wrote, but I think it fits right into your answer. I wrote something for BNA's Digital Discovery and e-Evidence called A Framework for Evaluating New Technology in the e-Discovery World. And I ran a case study on using video interviewing, and part of the conclusion was exactly what you said, the difficulties of control when there really are very few tools to take snapshots of video that were out there at that time. But I want to frame this a part of this question and part of this article into a question for Jim. You pointed out some of the pros and cons of evaluating the tools. They're fast, they're collaborative, you get a lot more insight from multiple people. Mike Scott, who's an attorney at Alcoa, gave me a quote in this article that said, "Technological and data innovation needs to be driven by the business needs of the enterprise. Does it help people do their jobs better, faster, and cheaper with higher quality, et cetera? And while you have a balance, have to balance exposure and risk, you use that balance analysis to manage the exposure, including litigation, risk costs, and avoid a useful technology only as a last and unlikely result where you cannot adequately mitigate exposure." Do you think companies are having this talk, this risk balancing discussion with about these types of technologies, and should they?
And that was a good article, Carl. I remember reading that quote because I think that was spot on. I don't see many companies having those discussions yet, and part of the problem is that we don't see a lot of companies still getting IT and legal and perhaps records management together to put plans in place to do data mapping, to talk about e-discovery, but they're starting to get there. But if you don't have these discussions, and a lot of times you can, if you don't have the discussions, you're going to get in trouble. And a lot of times if you have the discussions up front, you can head off problems that you would have down the line. And I think it's a simple example, but it's a really good one. We talked to a company maybe 2 years ago that was just getting ready to deploy a unified voice messaging, voice system. So telephone over IP with voicemails going out as attachments to emails. And you think about that. I know there's been a lot written lately that that's a huge discovery, e-discovery nightmare, when you have an email box full of WAV files that are just voice. It was very easy because they were at the beginning of the deployment just to talk about that issue, and the technical people figured out a way that they could just send out emails without the attachments and then manage the attachments back at a central server. So now with just literally a kind of a tweak of the technology that didn't matter to the users, you had a completely different situation where you could manage all of those voice files very easily, get rid of them, have them in one central place versus having those all distributed. And I think a lot of the technology that we're talking about fall into that same category. You know, using wikis, for example, if you deploy a wiki properly, it's very easy to have some kind of content management system on the back end so that changes are logged. You know who made them, you can roll them back, you can do some versioning and things like that. So most of the technologies, I'd say, have traits that let you manage them up front as long as you deal with the problem at the start and not after it's already been deployed.
Good point. Hey, Ron, you're sometimes an encyclopedia on case law, I found. You always have a case when I ask you questions. If you could talk about some of the cases that are out there which our listeners can look to for guidance in this exotic technology space where accessibility is an issue. I think we were talking about Columbia Pictures versus Bunnell yesterday. You want to expand on that a little bit?
Well, I hate to say Columbia Pictures versus Bunnell is old, but it is over 2 years old now. And on the other hand, it is interesting because it was the first decision that required the party to preserve random access memory. But there are a lot of permutations to that case, one being that the party had the technology to preserve the memory and effectively turn the switch off at one point. So there's a little more to it than the party just not being able to in the first place. But that caused quite a stir when litigants heard or corporate entities heard they might be required to preserve random access memory. And that goes back into this whole concept of ephemeral information I mentioned before, the type of electronic information that an entity may not need to keep for business purposes. There was a more recent decision earlier this year called Arista Records versus MySpace, or MyFace, I believe, and it's an old technology now. But it was, again, it was a question of a Web 2.0 entity, if you want to call it that, that was allegedly facilitating uploads and downloads of copyrighted works. And the court required the defendant there to preserve a lot of user information that it normally wouldn't. Interesting, though, the case there said that, you know, maybe you have a preservation obligation, but you may not realize it until somebody asks for it. So the type of information that was an issue in Arista may not be something that in the first instance an attorney talking about a hold may think there's a need to keep, all of which makes it more important, as Jim said before, when you're in these situations, to get IT, legal, and whoever together so you have a pretty good handle on what type of electronic information is within an organization's control, and you can make some early decisions about what you need to keep or not to keep.
Okay, well, let's look at some of the things you can do to protect yourself when you're starting to rely on some of these third parties to host information, you know, be it a Twitter or you're setting up a wiki or something like that. Is there anything you can do with drafting, say, policies at a corporate level or contracts with your third-party provider in this space? Ron and Jim, if you can both sort of tackle this together, we'll hear how many points you both get on this.
Well, the first thing I would say is you as an entity need to know who's got control of your data and where your data is. And I might enter into a contract with Jim to do some type of processing work for me or hosting work, and I may not know that Jim is shipping that data off by some subcontract outside the country. So I guess my start would be if you're going to want to do this, you need to do some due diligence when you get started and see where your data is going and see what kind of control you have over your data when it's being shipped off into the cloud.
We're seeing this a lot, Carl, with customers looking at having third parties host their email. And you think about how mission critical email is at this point, how important it is to e-discovery and compliance and other areas, but it can be compelling to certain entities to have a third party manage that data. So it's off in the cloud. Mm-hmm. And to Ron's point, you have to understand what's happening there, but up front, you've got to get, as part of the agreement, you've got to make sure that you address these issues of who else is handling the data, how's it being stored, what do I do when I need data to be preserved. You know, I need a service level agreement as part of that contract. The provider will respond within a certain number of hours or days or weeks or whatever it is that's important to you to be able to meet the criteria that you have internally to manage that data. Because I don't think courts are going to give you a free pass on spoliation simply because you say, oh, well, our data is managed by a third party, so you're going to make somebody issue a subpoena to that third party. I think it's still your data, and you need to get these things dealt with up front in the contract. And again, to Ron's point, we see a lot of times where customers are finally putting together their data map. So for their ESI purposes, for e-discovery, they're mapping out where their data is, who has it, and looking at the contracts that underlie that data. And they're finding, I think, that a lot of times more data is outsourced than they thought. It might be HR data, like a brass ring or something like that, but they're finding that they need to go back to those providers and get some pieces in place that let them manage that data better from that standpoint. I think it's going to be even more difficult with these Web 2.0 and 3.0 technologies, in part because they're blurring, to a certain extent, personal with enterprise in a lot of different cases, and so the law's a little bit cloudier on who manages the data and who owns it. And so for those purposes, I think company policies come into place, and those are very important too.
Yeah, we didn't talk about company policies, and you know, I'm not sure if you can put genie back in the bottle, you know, when someone starts doing this on their own time, but they're an employee. But, you know, are there any tips that you would have, Ron, on sort of drafting policies to protect yourself as a company from what someone does in 2.0, 3.0 world?
Well, the obvious solution is to tell them that they have no access to those technologies through corporate systems, and then hope that when they go home, they don't get access on their own systems and say things that affect the company one way or the other. I think the genie's out of the bottle on this, too. All I could suggest is that entities need to think of some type of policies, for example, to tell people, make sure if you're in these sites, because corporations want these sites to be used now. You see more and more evidence of it. You see more and more reports coming out about corporations and government agencies wanting these sites for, if nothing else, public relations purposes, maybe soliciting employment purposes. So I think it's more of a control of content than anything that a corporate entity can do. You can try to block a technology, or you can try to control what's being said on it. And the other thing I think you need in there, if you're going to have a corporate policy, is there has to be some type of discipline that's going to be imposed on someone if they violate one of these rules. It isn't pleasant, but that's, I expect, one of the things that a court is eventually going to look at if a corporation's hauled in to defend itself for a defamatory comment made by an employee against someone else.
Yeah. Well, Jim, if you're going to go ahead and embrace these technologies, which obviously is what's happening, what else can you do to prepare for electronic discovery? I mean, you'd mentioned in wikis and blogs that you might be able to set up your initial setup so that you could capture things that would be relevant for e-discovery. Do you want to expand on that?
Yeah, I think it takes us back first to step one. You've got to have that cross-functional team in place to talk about these things. And a lot of times the business needs a seat at the table, because sometimes companies will try to put draconian policies in place that just don't make any sense, or they so cripple the technology that it really, you know, the business users are going to get around it. You know, I think about companies that try to put in 15, 30-day email retention periods. It's very difficult to implement those, and the businesses don't like them. So having that group up front kind of look at these things and figure out what they're really being used for is critically important. But then the second piece to that is really having the technologies in place so that you can enforce the policies and the technology is still usable. So, for instance, when you set up a wiki, you know, the interface that the people using it see can be any number of things. It's really kind of the pipes in the background that matter. And so if you set up, say, a content management system or a database to manage all of the content on the back end, you can put policies in place, enforce, you know, how that content is archived or maintained, who has the right to change it, are you going to require review before it's published? All those pieces to the puzzle are very easy to handle with a little bit of technology in the background. Blogs are pretty similar. I mean, you know, wikis, blogs, web pages, there's a lot of similarities, at least on the technical side. And I think companies, for the most part, already have tools in place that let them manage and archive their web data, because that's been important in terms of what you're showing the public. So the same kind of technologies are there, too. And as you expand out into other things, and Ron was getting at some of these before, that are totally managed by third parties, or you have very difficult to manage data like, you know, a Facebook or a Twitter, as those start creeping into the enterprise. Technology-wise, if you're not managing the data itself, it's a little bit harder to manage. I think you need stronger policies, and then the forgotten components, discipline, which Ron mentioned, if you violate these policies, you need to get slapped on the hands, but also education, so that employees understand how they're supposed to do things and why. I think that's a component that frequently gets missed.
Ron, you had mentioned in one of your answers about, you know, some of the things that happen in the cloud and where that data is actually going. You'd mentioned a third-party subcontracted that's offshore. What are some of the issues you can run into if the data is actually hosted by a foreign company for e-discovery?
Depending on the jurisdiction you're in, and depending on how that jurisdiction defines data that it wants to protect, if information is located in the European country, for example, I could see arguments being made that data may be subject to the European Privacy Directive. It could be subject to a blocking statute of some jurisdiction which prohibits information being exported. You would think not, because we're talking about, say, an American company hosting data overseas. But if you're going to get into a situation where your data is going to be overseas, I think a responsible entity needs to not assure itself, but at least get some degree of comfort that they'll be able to access that data again without any problems involving the host country's laws. I just don't think it's a clear-cut issue. I haven't seen anything on it, but the possibility is certainly there. And then, you know, being realistic about it, the further the data is outside the United States, in a sense you could argue the harder it might be to get it back immediately. So one of the contract provisions I would look for in any kind of an agreement with hosting is that the host understands that they may need a relatively rapid return of data for litigation purposes. And the cost of that is something that has to be factored into an agreement.
I just wanted to add, this isn't such a small percentage of issues that can come up. I was looking at creating sort of a project management system online using Linux open source code. And the software that one of my colleagues was recommending, come to find out, was based in, I think, Czechoslovakia. And it was free. It looked like it could work, but for a number of reasons, I decided not to do it. But when you're dealing with the cloud, smart people can create cloud applications anywhere, and there are a lot of smart people all around the world that are focusing on these types of things. So,
and by the way, that brings in the whole other issue. We touched a little bit before about privacy and confidentiality. It's the whole question of security of all your data when it's being transmitted and hosted someplace else. So that's something else that needs to go into some type of a contract. And you have to have some provisions to deal with, for example, data breach issues and the like. If there's going to be some liability attaching on you as an organization because your data is lost or compromised somewhere.
Well,
that's just one factor.
Yeah, okay. Not everyone thinks about the contract in detail for a business application like this, and let's say you've entered into some type of an agreement, or you're using a third party hosting system. Maybe it was free. You just started using it. A lot of the social media is free. Now you need to get your hands on it, and the contract's silent on it. Or maybe you clicked OK on and didn't even read what flashed across your screen. You know, what happens next? What's the process there? If either one of you want to weigh in on that.
Well, I mean, from my point of view, the first issue would be if I was involved in litigation, can an argument be made that under those circumstances I have control over the data? If I have possession, custody, or control, I'm required to produce it. So my first thought would be, what happens when you click on it? What does it say about who maintains the data or who has the data? And go from there.
I think you're right. I think the control battle is where this battle will be fought first.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, too, that, you know, we're talking in most cases about a company that you really don't know much about. It could be one person working out of their home in a different country. It could be a big entity. You know, you have to decide how important is this data to you. Are you in litigation? Is there risk of spoliation? But making that initial contact, IT people tend to be extremely helpful, which is sometimes a detriment in e-discovery and sometimes it's helpful. But making that initial contact with a couple of phone calls, tracking down who has that data, how difficult is it going to be to get to it, you know, can you put an agreement into place real quickly if that's something that you want to do, you know, it's not a bad move to just do a little bit of homework first. And, you know, along the lines of what Ron's saying, if it's not in your control and custody possession, you know, maybe you issue a subpoena. You know, you're looking at good faith here, I think, that you're taking whatever steps are reasonable, and you're going to want to be able to sit in front of the judge and say, here's what I did, and, you know, we still were unable to get the data, if you have to go in and show the work that you've done.
I got one last, I think, scary question in this area, and it's in my area, search and retrieval. We're talking about some of these exotic web-based applications. Jim, what do you think about evaluating ESI coming off of a brand new web application in search and retrieval tools that people use today in litigation? Are we going back to manual review?
This is a huge problem. In EMC, we keep sponsoring these studies on how much data is out there and how quickly it's growing. And it's well beyond the point that in many cases you can really do manual review in any cost-efficient manner. You know, it's really about culling that data set down to a certain point after which maybe manual review is appropriate. So, you know, I don't know where that's going to take us in 3, 4, 5 years when we have 10 times as much data and probably a lot more than that, because we're understanding our obligations better in e-discovery. You know, with the article that you mentioned about avoiding faux e-discovery, I think we still have a lot of cases where companies are not really meeting their full obligation to preserve and collect data, but nobody's calling them on it, and maybe they don't even realize that they're not getting all the data. But over the next couple of years, the amount of data is just going to skyrocket, and we're going to have to put things in place that let us evaluate more of that data on some kind of search term or electronic basis, or else it's just going to be beyond the scope of anything we can do.
Absolutely. Search and retrieval is a very exciting area right now. We've done a number of podcasts on that with Judge Grimm and Judge Facciola over the last few weeks. I wanted to throw out one last question, and I think we decided at the beginning of the show that this maybe is a subject for a different podcast. But I did a podcast earlier in the week with Brett Burney on project management for electronic discovery, and I think it was an excellent show. I bridged the gap from moderator to guest, and I enjoyed being in that area since I've written on project management and e-discovery. Jim, when I look at one of the article that we talked about, you have a definition in here or a description that Web 2.0 technologies focus more on enhancing productivity and creativity through strong collaboration. That sounds pretty useful for e-discovery with a lot of the issues that are out there with miscommunication between parties or vendors or the other side. What are your thoughts about cloud technologies for project managing electronic discovery?
I think it's really interesting. You know, the difficulty in e-discovery is, I think, that even if you're talking about working with your adversary, obviously it's difficult, and I know Sedona's done a lot of work with the cooperation proclamation and trying to get parties to talk to one another. It's difficult to be transparent in that setting, whereas in an enterprise, you're all kind of pulling for the same team. So it's going to be difficult for transparency between parties. But if you're talking about the same side of a piece of litigation, you know, there's a lot of parties involved. You've got inside counsel, you've got outside counsel, you may have multiple outside counsels, you may have a vendor who's, you know, collecting data, and then one that might be contract attorneys or somebody to review the data, and getting collaboration between those parties is difficult. So I think any tool that helps that collaboration process and the communication is definitely worth investigating. Can you put that in the cloud? You know, the plus is so much easier to access. Maybe you can standardize. You know, there's some downsides along the lines of what we talked to before, but I think it's really intriguing.
Okay, Ron, what are your thoughts? I know you had some concerns, which are valid.
Well, what I think effectively you're talking about is taking the old concept of a data depository or a document depository, where one party would effectively gather all the documents that everyone produced and have it in one room so people could come in and look at it. And there have been online depositories done for years now, and if you look at the Manual for Complex Litigation, which the Federal Judicial Center issues, you'll see there's discussion there about online depositories in some way. I guess I have a couple concerns. I mean, number one is just the whole concept of security. In a lot of this litigation, you're going to see documents subject to confidentiality orders and the like that may be posted in this online depository. The security obviously has to be pretty robust to avoid anyone basically getting access to it or information leaking out. And the other problem is we're thinking about it, and Jim was talking about the need for transparency. And it's transparency really in the discovery process. So you try to avoid satellite litigation, so-called satellite litigation, where I don't want to discover the merits. I want to discover how Jim did something. And just thinking about it, if there was a depository, I as a lawyer might want to go in, manipulate the data myself to see what I can get out of it for my use. And unless there's some serious safeguards put in, I can see the possibility of work product protection being compromised by using this one site. So I'd like to see a lot more of it and see what kind of controls of access and the like there would be before I was willing to embrace it.
Well, on that note, we won't go any more deeply into this this possible hornet's nest, which may have a lot of honey. but anyway, thanks again for joining us on ESI Bytes. For a full list of podcasts, visit www.esibytes.com. You can use our scroll bar to find podcasts by speakers or by topic within the EDRM model or several other categories. And remember to visit ESI Bytes to learn about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. Thanks again, everyone, and have a nice day.